Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
And welcome to our Thursday open forum on Catholic Answers Live. Any question that you have about the Catholic faith is more than welcome. You don't have to be Catholic to call. 888-318-7884. The lines tend to fill up quickly on these open forum days, so you might want to start dialing if you've got a question you want to get in. 888-318-7884. I have to say it's kind of dead at the Catholic Answers offices today. Very few people here because everyone's over preparing for the conference that starts tonight. Hi, Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. I forgot to introduce you. I apologize.
I am here. That's okay. Yeah. I'm here and you are here and Aaron is here and Elisa is here.
Yeah,
and
there's four of us.
We are all together goo 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 goo.
And you look sharp in your white jacket. And I was just thinking.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned that on a day with no video because the video people aren't here. Yeah.
Right. But I was just thinking, I wish I – like it would be really cool to be like a Mark Twain type figure. Mm-hmm. Like you've got to look. And I think mm-hmm. Tom Wolfe did the same thing, a white jacket. Are you thinking mm-hmm. about that? Maybe just
developing? No. Well, I have a look that
a sartorial signature kind of.
That I change periodically, you know, slowly over. I mean, you're fairly new, so you haven't seen them all. But like I used to have my look was based around T-shirts that were from a company called The Mountain. They made a bunch of high-quality T-shirts.
Uh-huh.
And then I went through a phase where it was characterized by superhero T-shirts. And then I started wearing white slacks, uh-huh. and now I've added a white jacket to that.
Sweet.
Which will help because as I've lost the weight, the office is more cold to me. So the jacket will play a useful role.
I have found here at the Catholic Answers offices that it's often your immediate neighbors in their offices who mm-hmm. determine the temperature.
Yes.
So you can if you're a warm person and you need it cold, you're maybe making all the colder people miserable. But happy to have you here with us today for Open Forum. Tomorrow, I will remind those of you who would like to tune in tomorrow, we will be broadcasting live from the conference, from the floor of the conference. There'll be about 600, 700 people there, I suppose, and 2 hours of live broadcasting. So I've heard it before when Patrick mm-hmm. Coffin did it. And uh-huh. it's just a wonderful, energetic, fun day. So
uh-huh. Are you excited? That's what everyone's been asking me.
Yeah, well, I am actually because uh-huh. Especially for the show more than it's funny. My wife asked me that just this morning. I thought that's the thing, like the live show with everybody there with a room full of people is mm-hmm. what I'm looking forward to.
Cool.
Do you get fired up for these things? Because you're giving a talk.
Right.
On the Reformation.
What the Reformation was all about.
Yeah, what the Reformation was all about.
So I've been working on that and giving it at 10 a.m. Pacific tomorrow.
And Reformation Day is what? Well, that's like a week away or something?
A month away. October 31st.
And then we're going to do a special show that day. Has anyone invited you to the special show?
I might have forgotten.
Do we invite
Maybe.
Jimmy? Yeah.
Okay.
We're going to have
to check my calendar.
Several of the apologists, you and Tim Staples and
awesome.
Chris Check, and we're going to talk about the Reformation for 2 hours.
Oh, good.
If you want to stream the conference, you can just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com, and there's information on streaming it. So if you want to catch Jimmy's talk tomorrow morning at 10 on the Reformation, you can do that there. Again.
See the new white jacket that way.
Oh, you'll have the new white jacket there. Yeah. All right.
They probably have air conditioning in that room. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. these ballrooms there.
Especially if there's going to be hundreds of people in it, they're going to air condition it.
Right. Yeah. 888-318-7884, the number. Open forum means you are invited to call with any question you have. I told you that the lines fill up, and so they're full now. So just forget it.
How about that?
No,
we'll empty them out.
Yeah, they empty out, and sometimes people don't stay on the line. So give us a call, 888-318-7884. How about we go to calls, Jimmy? Because the lines are so full.
Because
Ryan,
we can.
In Midland, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Ryan, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Thanks for taking my call, guys. I thought I'd call today to give myself an early birthday treat for the Little Flowers Feast Day next Sunday, which is also my own birthday.
Happy birthday.
Oh, well, happy birthday coming up. Do you have a special devotion to the Little Flower?
Sort of. The main thing I have a devotion to is the Opus Dei founder.
Oh, I see. Yeah, right. And for those who don't know, the little flower is a name.
Nickname.
A nickname for a saint.
A cognomen.
Saint Therese of Lisieux. So your question, Ryan, for Jimmy.
Okay, Jimmy, I'm curious. I came across this photo on Facebook recently that supposedly showed the altar that St. Peter celebrated Mass on, and it was positioned to face the people. And I've been curious since seeing that. Is it possible Mass at some point in time was celebrated both ad orientem and with the priest facing the people before ad orientem was the decided on position that the priest should face in before all that took place before Vatican II?
Okay, so the first thing we should clarify is this is purely a matter of custom. This is not a matter of church law. So Vatican II, neither Vatican II nor anything after Vatican II declared that it needs to be celebrated one way or the other. And in fact, now what there is in the liturgical documents is there are directions at certain places that say the priest needs to do this facing the people. And so in the days when it was normal for in the Latin Rite for a priest to say most of the Mass facing the altar, facing ad orientem, facing the east, facing away from the people, then he would turn around at those points. But there was no rule that said he had to face that way. And it was normal because of the way churches were built. They were built facing the east typically. That's what ad orientem means. And the altar was generally flush with the wall, the back of the sanctuary, so he couldn't be standing behind the altar. So in order to face the altar, he'd have to turn his back on the people. And that was viewed as a normal thing to do because he's praying as our representative before God. He's not there to entertain us. He's there to talk to God on our behalf. And so it would make sense to have him facing the same direction as we are. And, you know, since Jerusalem is in the east, it's traditional to pray towards the east. And I mean, to some degree, it's traditional. And so he, like the congregation, would be facing the east. But then when he interacts with the congregation at certain points, he would turn around. This, though, is all a matter of custom. There were churches prior to Vatican II where the celebrant would not be facing east and where he would be facing the congregation. And in fact, St. Peter's Basilica is one of those. It has a freestanding altar. And so the Pope actually would, prior to Vatican II, be standing on the side of the altar that would face the congregation through the whole Mass, if I am not mistaken.
Okay.
I haven't verified that for 100%, but that's my understanding. But I know that there was a variety of practice on this because it's something that's simply something that's not spelled out, that you got to do it one way or the other. And that's the case today in the Latin Rite. Having said that, I haven't researched the early history of this, but given that it was not legislated, I would assume that there was a variety of practice in the history of the church, and that you in the earliest days found a mix, and there may not have been a standard preference at that time.
Ryan, thank you very, very much for that call. We've got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin. We come back right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Bishop James Conley of the Diocese of Lincoln. Keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is that now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn, that one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. Don't miss out on the most important, life-changing book to come along in years. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to the faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In John 1:47, when the Apostle Nathanael first met Jesus, he was overwhelmed over all that Jesus knew about him. Jesus responded that he would eventually see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Today, people often tell their children that they will become angels when they go to heaven. But we do not and cannot become angels. Angels are pure spirits and far more intelligent than we. The word angel means messenger. Those who are known for extraordinary messages are called archangels, such as Michael, Raphael, and Gabriel, whose memories we celebrate today. We refer to them as saints because saints are those beings who dwell in heaven. The angels are at God's beck and call. Theirs is the honor of serving Him directly and being fully aware of what they are doing and who they are serving. We have to wait for heaven for such knowledge, but heaven is well worth the wait. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open forum today. Any question you have on the Catholic faith, we are happy to take. 888-31-TRUTH is the number. Jimmy Aiken is our guest, and Curtis in Columbus, Ohio, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. You are next. What's your question for Jimmy Aiken?
Gentlemen, it is quite an honor to be speaking to both of you, and that includes you, Sty.
Curtis, thank you. I appreciate you including me. Thank you very much.
I'll try to make this as brief as I can. I was received into the church through the RCIA program in 1984 while I served in the U.S. Navy, the best thing I have ever done. I was not taught anything about the rosary. Hmm. Now, I started recently praying the rosary, and personally, I've been fighting Parkinson's disease and depression. And during and after praying the rosary, I felt and was blessed with this surprising and unexpected, deep, wonderful sense of grace and peace.
Oh.
Now, my question is this. What is the theology of the rosary? That is, why did it come to be? What is the idea or thought behind it as it has evolved, as you understand it, without, you know, being too detailed in this?
Okay. Well, so the rosary is a Marian devotion, and it also has a focus on Christ, the way the rosary is standardly prayed. It has a set of mysteries that are connected to the different, principally connected to the events in Christ's life and different phases of his life. And so as one asks Mary for her intercession, one also meditates on these mysteries, and that gives it a focus on Christ, what's commonly called a Christological focus. And basically, the meaning of the rosary is found in the prayers. It's typically begun with a saying of the Apostles' Creed. So we profess our faith. We pray the Hail Marys, asking Mary to be our heavenly prayer partner, to intercede with God for us. And we give glory to God. And so that's the fundamental set of things we're doing. We're praying, and the meaning of the prayers is contained in the text of the prayers, and then we have this added layer of meditation on the mysteries of Christ's life and of the Christian faith. And it's basically a way of asking God for his help and a way of growing closer to God and thinking more about his son Jesus Christ. In terms of how it arose, it arose in the Middle Ages through a process of historical development. There are some people who will attribute it to private revelation, but the historical evidence actually indicates that it was around in various forms and earlier than the reported private revelation. So It's something that in the West has become a very common devotion that the church has approved. It's not as common in Eastern Catholicism, but many Eastern Christians also pray the rosary, but it's not as common there as it is here in the West. So that's kind of a general sketch without going into a whole lot of detail.
Curtis, does that address your question about the rosary?
Oh, absolutely, and thanks so much. Where can I find, say, books, or could you recommend a book that would get more information or get more into the theology or the way of thinking that God thought behind all this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there are a lot of books on the rosary. I don't know of a particular one I could recommend. What I would suggest is going by our website, catholic.com, and typing in the word rosary and seeing what comes up in the search engine. That way it'll be some Orthodox Catholic content on the subject of the rosary.
Curtis, thank you very, very much for that call. Leslie in Houston, Texas is next, listening on EWTN. Leslie, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just have a simple question, hopefully the simple answer. I am wondering if it's allowed to get to have a Catholic wedding in a backyard or outdoors.
Typically, no. The Catholic Church recognizes that marriage is a sacrament, and it just like other sacraments, you know, baptism, the Eucharist, and so forth. And because it's a sacrament, it's a sacred rite, and therefore is typically to be performed in a sacred place, such as a church or an oratory, and a place that's specially consecrated to God and his worship. And since most people's backyards are not specially consecrated to God and his worship, they're not typical sites for weddings. So you would, at a minimum, need to get some kind of special permission for that. And my understanding is that typically that kind of permission is not granted.
Leslie?
Okay. And I was just wondering, because I have a friend of mine who, I don't know exactly where it was, but I know it was outdoors, and he was married, or he had a deacon do the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I was asking.
Yeah, well, deacons can sometimes perform weddings. They have to get permission from the person's territorial pastor in order to do that. But deacons sometimes do that. And if permission is granted to have an outdoor wedding, then, you know, it'll be valid. But that's not the norm.
Leslie, thank you for that call. Again, we lots and lots of calls today for Open Forum, but we will do our very best to get you in if you call 888-318-7884. Now we go to Messon in Santa Clara, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Messon, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Last time, you said Jimmy Akin also was just right, and someone asked it about the St. Mark Church, the St. Mark is a Coptic and Ethiopian Orthodox.
Uh-huh.
He said, he answered, that church doesn't have a fullness like Catholic. But my question is, I'm Orthodox, Ethiopian Orthodox.
Uh-huh.
I believe that my church has a fullness of full apostolic succession, and how come he, Jimmy Akin, knows very well about the church? He studied about the old church, or he studied about only Catholic church? And then he said, but because I was wondering, he said the Catholic church has fullness, but the church under St. Mark doesn't have fullness, he said.
Okay. So the reason is that, and we went through this briefly in our previous discussion of this, but one of the things that Jesus willed his church was that it be led by St. Peter. And he gave Peter a special role in ministry with respect to the other apostles. We went through the passages where he does that in the Gospels, passages like Matthew 16 and Luke 22 and John 21. And there are other passages in the New Testament that also indicates Peter had a special leadership role. And so, so consequently, within the College of the Apostles, they were led by St. Peter. And when the College of the Apostles was replaced by the College of Bishops, the College of Bishops also had a head who was the successor of St. Peter. And it's simply a fact of history that that office was inherited by the Bishop of Rome, because that's where Peter based most of his ministry, and that's where he ended up dying, and so that's where he left his successor. So it's not disputed, including as far as I'm aware, it's not disputed even by members of the Coptic Church, that the Bishop of Rome is the successor of Peter in a special way. They may have various ideas about, well, what does that mean in terms of what authority does he have, but they would acknowledge, okay, he's the successor of Peter. This is not a controversial proposition in Christian history, except in among the Protestant community. So given that, one has to ask a question, well, was this willed by Jesus that the College of Bishops have this special successor of Peter? If the answer is yes, and from a Catholic point of view it is yes, then that raises a second question. Is your church in communion with this successor of Peter? And if the answer is to that second question is no, then your church would not have something that Christ willed. And that means you wouldn't have the fullness of what Christ wills for his church. You may have a great deal of what Christ willed for his church. You may have apostolic succession. All of your bishops may be valid. You may have a validly ordained priesthood. You may have valid sacraments. You may have wonderful theology derived from the teachings of Christ. You may have all of that stuff. But if you're not in communion with the Bishop of Rome that Christ willed his church to have, then you lack at least one element of the fullness that Christ willed his church to have. And so that explains what I was talking about previously.
Messin, thank you very, very much for that call. I will say, Jimmy, I think in recent years, maybe even in recent months, many of us in the Western Church have developed a greater love and contact with the Coptic Christians of Egypt because of what they've suffered and how nobly they've suffered that. I mean, how they suffer for Christ.
And not just in recent years. I mean, they've had it. The Christian population of Egypt is about 15%, and the rest is Muslim. And they've had a difficult situation for a long time. But one of the positive notes is it's the growing warmth between the Christian community in Egypt and the Christian community in the West is that it hasn't just arisen in the last few years. The Coptic Pope and the Catholic Pope have in the past had a series of exchanges. They've signed joint professions of faith in Jesus Christ. They've talked about their desire to move into full unity. And hopefully in the not too distant future, you know, maybe within 100 years or something, we'll be able to reestablish full unity with our brothers in Egypt.
Indeed, and we have to keep them in our prayers, because I think it was Easter. Was it Easter or Palm Sunday? Do you remember where there was the bomb exploded in a Coptic church? I think it might have been Palm Sunday this year, and it was horrific, but so noble and forgiving, and a wonderful example to all of us of the Christian life and the Christian vocation. Let's see if we can get Tony in Black Duck, Minnesota on.
What a great name for a town.
I know. Tony in Black Duck.
Like Two Guns, Arizona.
Yeah. And oh, there's Two Guns,
Arizona? Arizona, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's more dangerous than Black Duck. But Tony.
Well, it might be dangerous for a Black Duck.
That's right. Tony, we'll probably have to get your question in and then do the answer on the other side. But what's your question for Jimmy Akin?
Okay. I was reading the Compendium of Catechism, and it's about the how the deceased is to be treated.
Mm-hmm.
How can there be cremation? How can we be allowed cremation if our faith says that we'll be reunited at the end of time with our bodies?
Okay. well, to give a very brief answer, it's been known since forever that after death our bodies decay, and frequently they fall completely into dust. And there's the music, so we'll talk about the rest of the answer on the other side of the break.
Hang on there, Tony and Black Duck. Don't go anywhere, because Jimmy is going to address that question. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Any question you have on the life, the faith, the history, the morals of the Catholic Church, we are happy to take those calls. 888-318-7884. We'll be right back after this with more on Catholic Answers Live.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
EWTN is now on Twitter. Get short, timely messages from EWTN on your computer or cell phone. It's easy to stay up to date on a wide variety of topics. Pro-life news, Vatican announcements, catechesis, apologetics, the latest EWTN programming, and more. You can link to EWTN on Twitter from our homepage or go to twitter.com/EWTN. At work, at home, at school, and on the road. Stay connected to your world with EWTN's Twitter page.
This is apologist Tim Staples, and I'm here to tell you about the most exciting and innovative Catholic book in years. In today's world, people from countless perspectives pose challenges to our Catholic faith every day. In conversations, through the mass media, on the internet, and more on the infinite collection of social media platforms. There's no getting away from this daily onslaught. We as Catholics need to stand strong to be prepared to mount a daily defense, to respond to the many challenges that we as believers are presented with every day. To that end, my good friend and apologist extraordinaire Jimmy Akin has come up with what will surely be a go-to resource for years to come, a daily defense. A daily defense takes up a different challenge for every day of the year, 366 in all, teaching you how you can defend the faith and give answers to Catholics and skeptics alike. And it's user-friendly, with challenges and answers indexed alphabetically by scripture verses or by topic, so finding the answers can be quick and easy. Order your copy of A Daily Defense today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. When we went to the break, Tony in Black Duck, Minnesota, which I've now said four times, and I'm going to try to say it three or four more before we go, was asking about cremation and how can we accept cremation given that we expect to be reunited with our bodies at the end of time.
Yeah, so what cremation does is it takes your body and it reduces it to tiny particles, except for the bones. Those typically have to be crushed. And but that's a process that happens to your body anyway after death, unless you're like mummified, where they get the moisture out of the body super fast, or unless you're put in an anaerobic environment where there is no free oxygen, like the bog people that we occasionally find, you know, and it's a form of natural mummification. Unless you're naturally or artificially mummified, your body's going to fall apart into tiny pieces anyway, and that's been known since forever. I mean, we see that in ancient documents. People are well aware of this. That's why in the beginning of Genesis, you know, Adam is told, dust thou art, and to dust thou shalt return. Mm-hmm. Your body's going to, after death, is going to fall apart into tiny particles, dust, in other words. And so the fact that our bodies are reduced to tiny particles, either by a natural process like decomposition or by an artificial process like cremation, is part of the normal occurrence of things, and it's not going to stop God from resurrecting us at the end of days. So it doesn't really matter how your body ends up being reduced to those particles. We don't have a positive burden to keep all of the particles intact. If we did, we'd be Egyptians and we'd be mummifying people. Egyptians in the ancient pre-Christian Egyptian sense.
Yeah, right.
And actually, that's something that the ancient Egyptians before the coming of Christianity did think, was that in order to be resurrected, you needed to keep the body preserved. And so they took elaborate steps to make this happen, and they have had a multi-stage process that it lasted like 70 days, the full process. They'd pack the body in this nitrate substance to rapidly dry it out. They'd remove the internal organs, which are full of water. They had a whole bunch of things they do, and of course, famously, they took the brain out through the nose.
Okay, thank you for that.
But I won't tell you how they did it.
Okay, good.
But they thought that you needed to keep the body together in order for it to be resurrected. Christians, though, that's not our view. God is omnipotent. He made the entire universe out of nothing. And so he can bring about any state of affairs that's logically possible. And since your body being put together is obviously logically possible because it's together right now, he can make that happen again. And so on the last day, God will put us all back together and resurrect us regardless of the state of our body prior to that time. Even if it's been reduced to atoms, it's not a big deal for God.
Thanks, Tony, in Black Duck, Minnesota. Appreciate that call. I hope you call again because I want to say Black Duck again.
Yeah.
Patty in Chino, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. You are up next with Jimmy Akin on Open Forum here on Catholic Answers Live. What's your question?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm so excited. I'm part of a bereavement ministry at St. Margaret Mary's, and I recently did a training where the nun that was teaching it said that the parishes are responsible for burying their parishioners as far as taking on the cost. Hmm. So I'm wondering if that's church doctrine or is that just diocese rules?
Well, it's certainly not church doctrine because parishes are something that are not divinely created. They're created by the church. A parish is basically a congregation that's organized in a particular way underneath a diocese, and it's the diocese that is the institution that has divine origin. Every local church is headed by a bishop. And even though we call individual parishes churches, really they're not a church in the same sense that the diocese is a church because they don't have their own bishops. And they may have priests, they may have deacons, but they don't have the bishop. And as St. Ignatius of Antioch said, and as the church endorses, without a bishop, it's not a church in the proper sense. And so within these proper local churches, which we would ordinarily call dioceses, or in the East they're called eparchies, there are various local congregations. But these local congregations are not a matter of divine law. It's not a matter of divine law that a given diocese must have, you know, some number of these local congregations. And so because they're the creation of ecclesiastical law rather than divine law, any financial arrangements that pertain to these entities will of themselves, again, be a matter of ecclesiastical law rather than divine law. Or they may not even rise to the level of law. It may simply be a policy instituted by a particular diocese. And so I'm not familiar with this area in the church's law. I'd have to look it up. But if a particular diocese has made this requirement, I would personally be a little surprised if that were in the code of canon law. I would suspect that on humanitarian grounds, if the family, for example, is not able to pay for a person's burial, or if the person has no known family, if the person's indigent, has no estate, then I would suppose on humanitarian grounds, the parish might intervene, and some dioceses might have it as a policy that that's to happen. But my understanding is normally in the Catholic Church, as elsewhere, the costs of burial are ordinarily taken care of by the family, usually out of the estate of the person in question.
Okay, Patty?
Right. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. We go now to Theo in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on 98.9 FM. Theo, your question for Jimmy Akin.
And that's Sacred Heart Radio.
That's Sacred Heart Radio. Okay, good. Thanks for the plug.
Okay. And I was debating with a Jehovah's Witness about Jesus being God, or she was saying that Jesus is not God, and she took me to Proverbs 8:22. And that the Lord created me at the beginnings of his work and the first of his acts of old, ages ago was set up, and it goes on and on about is that about Jesus, and how can I counter that?
Okay. There are a couple of things here. Now, in the beginning section of Proverbs where we find this, we have an extended meditation on wisdom. And in this passage, wisdom is depicted as a woman. And that's natural because the word for wisdom in Hebrew, chokmah, is a feminine word. And so it would be natural, given that it's a feminine word, to depict wisdom as a woman. And that means that when this passage is applied to Christ, and we don't want to deny that there's a sense in which Christ is the wisdom of God, that's something that comes out in the New Testament, we have to recognize that this is a metaphor. It's an analogy. First of all, it's an analogy just in the book of Proverbs itself, or I should say it's a metaphor just in the book of Proverbs itself, because wisdom is not literally a woman. Wisdom is a quality that God has, and it's a quality that we have in some measure, but wisdom is not literally a woman. So this whole passage, just from the starting gate, is metaphorical. It's not literal. And anytime you're dealing with metaphors, you have to ask, what are the limits of the metaphor? Because if something's a metaphor, that means it's similar in some ways to something else, but it's also different. Because if there were no differences, then it wouldn't be a metaphor. It would be the same thing. If I'm talking about, say, the computer terminal in front of me, and I'm talking about an entity that has all and only the properties of the computer terminal in front of me, then I'm not using a metaphor. I'm just talking about the computer terminal in front of me. So in order for there to be a metaphor, there have to be differences, and we therefore need to be aware of those differences. So when we read that God created wisdom in the beginning, we can understand from that that wisdom is something that goes all the way back to creation, but that doesn't mean we can just transfer that to Jesus any more than the fact that we can transfer the depiction of wisdom as a woman to Jesus, because Jesus obviously was not a woman. He was a man. So if the text contains a limit or a difference involving the metaphor with respect to something as fundamental as the sex of the individual in question, then it can involve differences on other things too, like, is Jesus created or not, or is the second person of the Trinity created or not? So that's one response. A second response is the Hebrew verb here, kana, that's used for create in the translation that you're quoting from and the Jehovah's Witness is quoting from, doesn't only mean create. It also can mean to bring forth or to bear a child. And in fact, the Christian faith acknowledges that Jesus is in an eternal, timeless way begotten of the Father. That's why in the Creed every week we say he was begotten of the Father before all ages, meaning that the second person of the Trinity proceeds from the first person of the Trinity in a timeless way outside of the course of history. So there is no point in history before he existed. This is a timeless, eternal begetting, and it's consistent with the use of the verb kana in Proverbs 8. So even if you wanted to say that this particular statement applies directly to Jesus, well, if you interpret it in the Orthodox Christian way of the Son is eternally begotten of the Father, well, then fine.
Theo, thank you so much for that call. We have to take a quick break. We'll be back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Bringing you the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Jesus called the devil the father of lies, and every time someone tells a lie about the Catholic Church, they're doing the devil's work. Satan is busy today, which is why so many lies are being told about the Church. How many times have you heard people say things like, Jesus wasn't a real person, he was just a mythical figure created by Christians. The Church took Christmas and Easter from pagans. The Catholic Church suppressed certain books of the Bible. The Church is opposed to science. The Church was a willing tool of Nazis and fascists. The Church is, and always has been, an oppressor of women. Combating lies like these is what Catholic Answers is all about. And that's why we've just published The Real Story of Catholic History, an eye-opening new book by historian Steve Weidenkopf. In it, he debunks more than 50 anti-Catholic myths, covering subjects like Jesus in the early church, the Middle Ages, the Crusades, the Inquisition, the papacy, the Reformation, and more. To make your donation and get your free copies of The Real Story of Catholic History and Catholic Controversies, visit Catholic.com and click the Exposing Anti-Catholic Lies banner, or call us toll-free at 888-291-8000. That's the Exposing Anti-Catholic Lies banner at Catholic.com, or call toll-free 888-291-8000.
Face it, it's tempting and easy to be a man of the world. Father Terence Ehrman has a challenge for you. Be a man of God instead. In his new book, Man of God, Father Ehrman draws on his experience counseling men who are struggling to live in the world but not be of the world. In a unique, easy-to-read format, he offers holy spiritual direction for all men who want to master themselves and be transformed from within. Order your copy of Man of God today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live Open Forum. Jimmy Akin with us for the rest of this hour. Next hour, Father John Trigilio will be here with us, and we will continue Open Forum. That means if you're on the line, stay on the line. If we don't get to you by the top of the hour, though we will do our best. And if you would like to call and get in line, just give us a call at 888-318-7884. Open Forum is open to anyone. You don't have to be Catholic. You don't have to be Christian. You can be anybody at all, and you can call and ask any question you'd like about the Catholic faith, about Catholic life. We're happy to take those calls. We'd love to talk about it. Sean in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, listening on 97.3 FM. You are on with Jimmy Akin. Your question, Sean?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I work at a cultural heritage center, and I spent many years studying a variety of cultures from around the world. And I've noticed a lot of cultures, the majority of cultures, reduce their philosophy down to one principle of balance. Even science sort of reduces its philosophy down to gravity, which is, you know, balance is what we're looking at. And all of these cultures have their own rituals and their own ways to express balance. And even within Judaism, we have the Aron HaBrit, the Ark of the Covenant, which is the balancing of male and female. The two cherubim on top, or Judaism teaches our male and female. You mentioned Chokhmah being female, and Bina being the male side of that. So there's this universal idea of balancing of male and female. Why is one culture's ritual presentation of balance more pertinent and more necessary? In other words, why would we have to attach to the culture of Christianity to enjoy the philosophy of balance?
Okay. I guess I would say a number of things here. The first one is that balance is something that appears in many cultures in many different forms, and it appears in science as well. However, I don't know that one can make it or take it as an absolute. And it sounds like you might be thinking of it as if it's the highest value, and I'm not rejecting that view, but I'm also not sure that it's a fully adequate description of things. For example, with science, you mentioned gravity. Well, gravity is something – I'm not exactly sure how you would characterize gravity in terms of balance. Gravity is an attractive force. It always attracts. It's different than some of the other forces we have, like the electromagnetic force can either attract or repel. And I could see, well, okay, we have some clear balance in the universe regarding electromagnetism, because the number of positively charged particles in the universe is balanced by the number of negatively charged particles. And that's why, for the most part, electricity, which is actually much more powerful than gravity. That's why electricity doesn't dominate our universe, is because it evenly balances. But and thus gravity, which is a much weaker force than electricity, is able to do things like cause matter to clump together, because that matter is neutrally charged. The charge of the atoms on the planet Earth balance out, allowing gravity to pull them together. But there's no counterbalance to gravity, so far as we know. We haven't found anything that has negative mass. We haven't found anti-gravity. And so it's not clear to me that one can, even though balance is something that is around in the world and it's obviously very important, gravity wouldn't work. We wouldn't have planets and stars if the universe were electrically unbalanced. So obviously balance is something that's very important, but I don't know that we can treat it as if it's the only relevant criterion. And for that reason, I wouldn't make my argument for Christianity based on balance. I would make it based on truth. Now, there are many situations in which in assessing truth, we need to approach it with a balanced perspective, meaning we need to give the evidence and the arguments their proper weight. We shouldn't skew the evidence one way or another. We shouldn't fail to attend to relevant arguments or give them more importance than they deserve or less importance than they deserve. But fundamentally, the question of why one should be a Christian comes down to, is it true? Not is it balanced? I would say, yeah, it is balanced, and there are a lot of indications of that, because balance is a fundamental part of the human experience. And, you know, we even see it in our own bodies. Our blood pressure can't be too high or too low. Our blood sugar can't be too high or too low. Our saline content in our blood can't be too high or too low. So we see balance all over the place just in human nature. Naturally, that's going to manifest in every culture, including Christian culture. But the ultimate question is Christianity true? And it's the job of the discipline of apologetics to show, or of Christian apologetics, to show that Christianity is true. And that's typically done through a number of means, such as by demonstrating the existence of God and then proceeding to demonstrate the fact that Jesus Christ lived and that he ministered and that he rose from the dead. And that miracle shows us that Jesus Christ had a prominent place in God's plan, that Jesus is then qualified as a prophet who produced a miracle to tell us about, and a very striking miracle at that. And so those are the lines on which I would tend to argue for Christianity, rather than arguing it has a superior form of balance. I'd say, sure, it has balance. That's an important concept. But fundamentally, what's important is it true? And just like I would bring forth scientific evidence rather than just the concept of balance to show some scientific truth like gravity and its relationship to electromagnetism, in the same way, I would bring forth apologetic evidence to show the truth of the Christian faith and not simply the idea that it has balance.
Sean, thank you very much for that call. We move now to Robert in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Robert, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, my question is, we know God's omniscient. Is it true that he knows not only all things that are and were and will be, but all things that could have been and could be and could be in the future?
Yes.
So he knows not, yeah. So does he know in a way that is qualitatively different than we know?
Yes.
Okay. So is that possibly an answer to the charge that is sometimes given that God could not be simultaneously omnipotent and omniscient and omnibeneficent? Because the argument goes, if God knows what's going to happen and is good, he would act in a way to prevent bad things. And I know there are other arguments against that, which I think are sound, but is this also an argument against it? That
I'm not seeing the – so we have to talk about in what way God's knowledge is different than ours. One of the ways that God, and there's more than one way, but one of the ways that God's knowledge is ordinarily viewed as being different than ours is not just that it's comprehensive, that he knows everything that can be known, but that it also isn't propositional, that it doesn't depend on expression in individual propositions the way our knowledge does. It's a direct knowledge. It's not mediated by anything else, which is also different than our knowledge. I'm not sure how any of those facts would answer the problem of evil, which is what you're referring to. I don't exclude that there could be a relevant difference here, but I don't immediately see how these differences in God's knowledge and how it works would solve the problem of evil. I would tend to stick with some of the more classic explanations and say, well, God has he does have the ability by virtue of his omnipotence to prevent various evils from occurring, and he knows how to do it, but he chooses not to do it in order to allow some greater good, some equal or greater good to occur. And so I suppose if I were focusing on the role of God's knowledge in that, I could say, well, it's the comprehensiveness of his knowledge, since he knows a way to bring good out of it. If he didn't know a way to bring good out of it, well, then he wouldn't let it happen. So I suppose there might be a way to frame it, given the comprehensiveness of God's knowledge, to say, well, there is a solution to the problem of evil in that if he knew of a way, and if there was a way, he would know of it, and he therefore wouldn't allow this evil to occur if there was no way to bring good out of it. So I suppose there may be a way to do it, but beyond that, nothing occurs to me off the top of my head.
Robert.
Yeah, the only idea I had was, is it possible that God doesn't know any distinction between things that might be but aren't and things that might be but are? And so the argument that God knowing things that do happen, he should act to prevent them in his goodness.
Okay,
if he doesn't know them in a different way than things that didn't happen, doesn't
okay.
make sense.
God knows everything that's possible, and God knows everything that's actual. But there is a question, theologically, of does God know things that would happen in certain conditions, but those conditions never arise? And that kind of knowledge is known as middle knowledge. There is a open question in theology about does God have middle knowledge or not? And that actually can be relevant to the question of the problem of evil. I'm afraid, though, that we're too close. It's rather complex, and we're too close to the end of the show right now for me to go into that today. But if you want to call back on another day, we can talk about that.
And you've got the phrase. You can try looking into middle knowledge a bit yourself. Is it near Middle Earth?
They probably have middle knowledge in Middle Earth.
They got everything else there.
Something like that.
888-318-7884, the number. Next hour, Father John Trigilio will be here with us. More open forum. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. And one more time, I will mention this. Catholic Answers Conference starts tonight around 7 p.m. Pacific time. We'll start with the talks. And if you would like to get the streaming version of that, just go to CatholicAnswersConference.com. And all the information to stream is right there. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Cy Kellett.
Looking forward to your talk tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I really do like the white jacket.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. We'll be right back with Father John Trigilio after this on Catholic Answers Live.